Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. At Voice of America. It's great to be
here. The movement you coordinate has a very interesting name. It's basically what the Uzbek cotton picking season is called in Uzbekistan, the cotton campaign. Right. Who are you and what do you do?
Right. Thank you. It's great to be here with Voice of America. The cotton campaign is a global coalition of human rights NGOs, non-governmental organizations, trade unions, business associations, and socially responsible investors. And we work together to end forced labor in the cotton sector. So we've started with Uzbekistan because the forced labor in Uzbekistan is state orchestrated, and it's the largest state orchestrated forced labor system of cotton production in the world. We have started to also advocate for the end of the forced labor system in Turkmenistan, a neighbor to Uzbekistan, precisely because it is very similar to the forced labor system in Uzbekistan, being state-led and on a mass scale. And yet we recognize that there are serious concerns about forced labor and other labor abuses in other cotton production locations.
So this is basically an international movement with its current focus being on Uzbekistan.
That's correct. That's correct. Being the most egregious, largest scale, and state-led forced labor in the cotton sector.
And when was it started and who financially supports you?
So we have been around for quite a long time in various formations. So going back as far as the 1990s, many of our Uzbek partners were already reporting on forced labor and, of course, other human rights concerns in Uzbekistan. It was in the early 2000s that international actors started to pay attention. The International Trade Union Confederation and International Organization of Employers, which represent workers and employers to the ILO, the International Labor Organization, started to raise complaints at the ILO, and that was as far back as 2005. In 2007 and 8 is when a broader multi-stakeholder and global coalition came together, when investors recognized that this was a major risk to, in terms of business liability and brand reputation, and many companies also recognized those risks. So they started to get more and more involved as well. And that's when the Cotton Campaign as a coalition, as we know it now, came together. The financial backing has come from several areas. There are about a dozen organizations that make up the steering committee of the Cotton Campaign. Only a few of those receive funding directly for our advocacy and monitoring and reporting in Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan. And organizations like Open Society Foundations, National Endowment for Democracy are some of those supporters financially. But the other two-thirds of the most active members of the Cotton Campaign dedicate their own budgets. So we're talking about organizations like the AFL-CIO or like the Retail Council of Canada or like Mercy Investment Services, which are organizations that have an entirely different financial structure, do not get grants for this work, but see it as part of their core business to ensure that their own operations as companies or their members who are companies or the companies they invest in are ensuring that their supply chains are free of forced labor cotton.
You mentioned your local partners. How much support do you have on the ground in Uzbekistan? Are we talking about activists, human rights organizations, mm-hmm. or do you also feel like there is some kind of business support that you have?
Sure, sure. Well, it is difficult to gauge any broad opinion in Uzbekistan. That has been a challenge from the start, that there are not There's not freedom of expression recognized by the Uzbek government, and therefore it's difficult to conduct mass surveys and things of that nature. We work with a lot of citizens who are activists and bravely take it upon themselves to go out and document human rights abuses and report out on those. And so over the years, we've worked with them to provide them additional skills and knowledge of international conventions, as well as brought them together with Uzbek lawyers to really get a firm grasp of national laws as well. And they really base all of their documentation on the national law of Uzbekistan to say, you know, we, under our own law, do not allow forced labor, therefore citizens do have the right to say, no, I do not have to do this work. In terms of business support in Uzbekistan, it is highly likely that a lot of businesses would see our messaging and say, yes, we agree with that, because what we call for are for farmers, who at the end of the day are small businessmen and women, to have the ability to earn sufficient income cultivating their crops that allows them to hire voluntary labor, invest in their farms, both in terms of using new equipment as well as agricultural practices that can sustain farming over a long period of time.
So when you are speaking against forced labor in Uzbekistan, you do feel like you're speaking on behalf of Uzbek farmers or whoever would support your movement, right? You are
absolutely
confident about that. Because, you know, there has been a lot of criticism. Obviously, you have very harsh critics out there, not just within the Uzbek government system, but other governments too who work with the Uzbek regime. Right. And, of course, as far as the Uzbek government is concerned, you are paid agitators. You are the front for the business lobby. You're not interested in constructive engagement. You want to protest and scream, but you're not necessarily interested in real solutions. How do you usually respond to that kind of criticism?
Right. Oh, we're well aware. So, first of all, I think it's important to look at all of our messaging. We are very open and transparent about everything we do. All the publications we've ever put out are on our website. We circulate them broadly to both folks who agree with our positions and those who do not. And we base all of our information directly on evidence that our partners on the ground gather. And the type of evidence they gather are documented orders from government officials ordering the mobilization of people to work in the cotton fields, documents that indicate that students and public sector workers are required to participate under threats of being expelled from school or losing their jobs. So that's the essence of forced labor. So we're very clear that what is being done is a violation of not only international conventions, but Uzbek law. We're also very clear that the farmers are not benefiting from this system. The finances are structured in a manner that the income from cotton disappears. We would like to see the Uzbek parliament have access to the expenditures and income in the cotton sector, but they don't. It disappears into a fund in the finance ministry that is called the Sokol's Fund. So the information we have is very highly documented based on the evidence. The violations are very clear. In terms of backing, it's hard not to laugh when we hear the criticism that we represent some kind of lobby group for industry. Number one, the Uzbek cotton industry and the U.S. cotton industry have nothing to do with each other on a competitive basis. We have no ties with the U.S. cotton industry. And when we have a engagement with companies, what we're engaging the companies on is doing their proper human rights due diligence to ensure that there's not forced labor in their supply chains.
So the businesses that are joining your movement, are you saying that they're predominantly interested because of the violations of human rights in Uzbekistan, and then they're afraid that they may be using cotton that is picked through forced labor in their products. Is that the concern that they have, or?
Right. So, of course, I can't speak for each company themselves, but our message to companies is that it is unacceptable for you to sell a product to consumers that you know has forced labor in its production. In order to avoid that, you need to proactively look at your supply chain, including, is your cotton coming from Uzbekistan? And currently all the cotton coming from Uzbekistan is made with forced labor. So our message to companies is, this is a duty that you have. This is a responsibility you have. If you're going to have a global supply chain, you need to have control over that. So the motivation for companies is, yes, they're investors. Investors don't want to see companies using forced labor products. Laws, U.S. law prohibits the importation of goods produced with forced labor, even if it's not entirely produced with forced labor. So, for example, if a T-shirt has forced labor cotton in it coming into the United States, that could risk a violation of U.S. law.
So this is what you call the pledge, right, which has been going on right now. Over 175 apparel brands and clothing lines have signed this pledge.
Absolutely, that's right. And so all of these apparel brands, which we all recognize, they're the names that we see in retail stores around the world, said, well, we need to send a public message to the Uzbek government, because at the end of the day, we're talking about a policy. And so, yes, all of these brands, over 175, have signed a pledge to avoid cotton from Uzbekistan so long as the Uzbek government continues to use forced labor. And why does that matter? It seems like it would take more than a message from companies to the Uzbek government. That's true, but we have seen the result of pressure both from industry and from the diplomatic community around the world have an effect on decision making in Tashkent.
I want to get to that.
Sure.
But before that, I want to know how you are assessing this season. The Uzbek government is very happy. The state plan has been achieved. The country has produced over 3.5 million tons of cotton. Hundreds of deals have already been signed to export a lot of it. Mm-hmm. So Tashkent is fine. You know, despite the pressure that you're putting on it, the Uzbek cotton has demand.
Yes, it does. And it's very disappointing to see this year's cotton production cycle be so similar to every year in the history of Uzbekistan. Once again,
we've seen no improvement.
We've not seen any change in the forced labor system. We've seen
less forced labor.
No less forced labor. We've seen precisely the same process of the government imposing quotas on farmers under threat of taking away their land, as well as we saw this summer several farmers' crops destroyed because local authorities decided that was supposed to have been cotton. We saw a farmer in July take his own life after he was very harshly treated for the umpteenth time by local officials for not meeting his quota. So we've seen that dynamic between the government and farmers continue, in which farmers are coerced to produce a quota for the government cotton industry under threat of penalty. That has continued. All through the spring, we saw the government forcibly mobilize thousands of citizens to weed the cotton fields. Starting in the second week of September, the harvest really took off, and we saw the same type of mobilization with the use of coercion that we've seen every year in the history of Uzbekistan with this government. And so we're very disappointed to see that despite commitments by the government to the International Labor Organization, to the World Bank, to diplomatic partners, that it has not changed its forced labor system whatsoever.
Do you consider the International Labor Organization a partner?
We do. We think.
Are you in touch with them? What kind of monitoring have they done this year?
We are in touch with the ILO, and we do think they have a very significant and vital role to play in Uzbekistan. Uzbekistan is a member of the ILO. The ILO's members include governments and representatives of workers and representatives of employers. And therefore, we've always encouraged the government to invite the ILO to have unfettered access to assess the situation. It has been difficult because the government has wanted to control the relationship, right? So, you know, we saw for the first time the ILO monitored only child labor in 2013, so a couple years ago.
And they did not do any kind of monitoring last year.
No, they did not. And that was because there was not agreement from the Uzbek government side to say, yes, we would accept monitoring of forced labor last year. This year, they did accept monitoring of forced labor led by the ILO with teams that include representatives of the Labor Ministry as well as the Uzbek Trade Union Federation and the Uzbek Chamber of Commerce. We think that that can be helpful. We have been working with our monitoring team, who are all independent of the government, to provide information on almost a daily basis to the ILO to make sure that they're seeing everything. Because our concern is that the government is putting a lot of pressure on the ILO to underreport forced labor and to claim that a lot of people are out there working in the fields voluntarily, when in fact what we see is that a lot of people are forced to go work under threats of various penalties. You know, I mentioned expulsion for students or being fired for public sector workers, but there are also pensioners and mothers who receive social welfare benefits who are threatened by the neighborhood committees, the mahallas, that their welfare benefits can be cut if they don't go and pick cotton, right? And so in turn, we see a lot of these people. If I were a doctor in Uzbekistan and my chief doctor says to me, you need to go pick cotton for 2 weeks, I may say, well, I have sufficient money to hire somebody, so I'm going to go hire somebody who's in this village and perhaps doesn't have a job. You know, parentheses, Uzbekistan has a major unemployment and underemployment problem, right? So there are people who are looking for work. So I go and hire somebody, and then if monitors from the ILO-led monitoring teams come out and say, you know, investigate, they may hear from the person I hired, yeah, I'm out here voluntarily working for a salary, except for the fact that that salary is being paid by me, the doctor, who is forced by my employer to contribute. So citizens are in turn financing the government's cotton sector, and we see the same coercion is there, and that's what we're trying to get rid of, is the coercion.
Seeing all that, that complex, corrupt environment, one may wonder why a bunch of foreign human rights organizations and companies care so much about such a local issue that when you look at the society, they may not be caring as much. They seem to be fine. And there are many Uzbeks who argue with movements like you, saying that you don't really need to do this because it's our problem, we need to resolve it. And guess what? It's not necessarily a problem. Right. We're fine with it. This has been a way of life you know, for Uzbekistan for a long time. And especially when people who are working for you, with you, are also being targeted by the National Security Services. We know of so many stories where their lives have come under.
Absolutely. And I think that is precisely the role.
Is this all worth it?
Absolutely. That is precisely the role of a globalized solidarity movement, right? In Uzbekistan, the government has used fear so effectively for literally generations that it is smart for an Uzbek citizen to say, I don't care about this. I am perfectly fine with this. Even though if you or I were sitting in Karakol, Pakistan, and look, I am not able to make any income on my farm because the government sets a price below my production costs. my neighbors are forced to come work on my farm, even though I don't actually want them there. I don't think most citizens in Uzbekistan fail to see the problems here. They don't fail to see that their local officials are imposing obligations of work on them under threats of penalty. They don't fail to see that they're being demanded bribes through extortion schemes in order to avoid work that has nothing to do with their professional aspirations as nurses, as teachers, as police officers, for that matter. So I think this is a very universal human issue, and that's precisely why the prohibition of forced labor is a universally held norm that very few countries in the world would argue that it's actually a good thing. And in fact, the Uzbek government has ratified all the forced labor conventions to say, no, we agree with the international community that coercion is not the appropriate recruitment factor. And so what does it mean for Uzbek citizens? It means having socioeconomic development that would contribute to communities. It would mean 10 years from now that the agricultural sector in Uzbekistan is supporting the agricultural communities of Uzbekistan. And those farming families are earning income, able to hire people, contributing to more employment in the country, contributing to more national income at the end of the day. That would benefit the vast majority of the 30 million people in Uzbekistan. It would stop benefiting the small clique of government elite that are currently benefiting from the current system.
Have you ever interacted with the Uzbek government? Have you ever held conversations with them? I'm not talking about negotiations, just the dialogue. Have you been able to start anything that we can call a dialogue?
Yeah, so we have reached out repeatedly and continuously over the years to the Uzbek government. In 2011 was the last time that the then ambassador of Uzbekistan to the United States met with several organizations involved in the cotton campaign. Since then, they have refused to meet with us. And, you know, we're very clear that we will continue to report the use of forced labor by the Uzbek government as long as it occurs. And we are continuously identifying what next, right? What are the solutions to this? We have consistently repeated recommendations both to the Uzbek government itself through written form and to all the international and bilateral partners that work with the Uzbek government that there are very clear things that the government could do to do the transition I was talking about before, going from a forced labor system to a voluntary labor system that really would support the stated goals of the Uzbek government to have a strong economy, to have a developing population, right? So they could do things right now like increase the price that they pay to farmers for the cotton, stop the use of coercion against farmers who don't meet their quotas, and allow farmers to have access to not just the current monopoly of input providers, but a broad array of providers, suppliers of agricultural inputs, and have access to markets to sell their cotton.
What do you say to those who say those are like impossible? Mm-hmm. That would be impossible, and mm-hmm. it ever happens, it would be a miraculous development.
Sure,
you know, to really go from what you have now in Uzbekistan to something that you are recommending. Right. You have been critical mm-hmm. of the World Bank mm-hmm. projects mm-hmm. That focus on the agricultural sector in Uzbekistan. Mm-hmm. When you talk about solutions, a lot of experts say, well, the Uzbek agricultural system needs to be mechanized so that the government doesn't use forced labor to pick cotton, which is the white gold, which is the main national product.
Right.
Why are you opposing those projects?
Right. Because it puts the cart before the horse. What we've been saying to the World Bank all along is you have unique leverage with the Uzbek government. You have the ability to finance significant reforms. If you give the finance before there's real commitment to those reforms, then you're not going to achieve those goals. And the World Bank, I think at this point, understands very clearly that the things that need reform are really the financial infrastructure of the agricultural sector. Tractors, mechanization of harvesting is really a side issue. It's a tool. It's, you know, like any other tool. It depends on the farmer's ability to have access to that, and that means financially access those tools, and to use it. The farmer's ability to use those tools. And if a farmer can harvest his entire crop with a tractor, but still is getting a price that's below the production costs, then he's still in debt, right? He's still indebted to the government for that quota. And so what we have been encouraging the World Bank to do is to use its financial economic expertise and have a very serious discussion with the Uzbek government about reforming the banking and financial infrastructure underneath the agricultural sector.
You're talking about huge, deeply
right.
fundamental reforms
That's right.
that have to deal with the economic freedom,
right.
the way the whole society and the system functions.
Yeah.
Do you think that the World Bank will be willing to take such huge undertaking?
Well, I think that's its job. The World Bank doesn't exist to just push out loans. Its mission is ending poverty, right? If you want to end poverty in a sector like the agriculture system in Uzbekistan, you have to look at the root causes. They sound large and significant, but what we're talking about is a shifted distribution of resources. This is a major economic sector for Uzbekistan, but right now it's only benefiting a small sector of the elite. So what we're talking about, the intervention of the World Bank, is in challenging the Uzbek government to be a real partner. And
well, in many ways, you are asking them to lead these reforms, right. which they can easily say, well, the government has to meet us halfway.
That's right.
We're going to be able to accomplish anything only if the government is willing to do that, if there is enough political will.
That's right.
You know, on the ground.
Absolutely. And at the end of the day, this is a political will question, right? This is how far is the government willing to shift its practice in order to contribute more to the population, the general population, as opposed to maintaining this system which only benefits a small sector of the population.
You have a very difficult task.
<You do. laughs>
The American Uzbek Chamber of Commerce just held its annual business forum here in mm-hmm. Washington to obviously attract more investment from this country. What would you say to these companies who are already working actually, or potential investors,
right.
if they came to you, I guess,
right.
asking for your insights and advice?
Sure, sure. What we do say to the members of the American Uzbek Chamber of Commerce is that Uzbekistan right now is an environment that presents high risks of human rights violations to any company investing there.
So don't invest there.
Well, if you're going to invest there, many of these companies already are. I mean, we're talking about General Motors, by some estimates, has 90% of the car market.
It is the success story.
It is there, right?
Yes.
And it is in partnership with the Uzbek government for two major facilities in Uzbekistan. And what we say is that, look, you're there. We're not asking you to leave today, but we are asking you to fulfill your responsibilities as a global company, right? And that means knowing the risks of contributing to human rights abuses by your operations and your business partners, and mitigating those risks.
Mm-hmm.
And if you really can't mitigate the risks, if you really do identify that your operations are contributing to human rights violations and you can't do anything to mitigate that, then yeah, you ought to divest. So what could a company like General Motors or General Electric or some of the other AUCC members do? Well, number one, they could publicly commit to not contribute either personnel, so labor, financially or in kind to the cotton harvest, so long as there's forced labor. They could also be very clear with the Uzbek government that they are aware of some of the reported bribery schemes that have other multinational companies have been involved with, such as TeliaSonera. And they could report back to their own home country governments if they have any situations like that, right? So I think companies from multinational companies working in Uzbekistan have an obligation to be highly transparent and involve independent monitoring of their operations so that their home country governments can really have a view of, are they doing everything they can do to avoid entanglement with some of the human rights concerns in Uzbekistan.
Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Daniel Rosenblum, speaking at this business forum on Monday, did mention the problem of forced labor in Uzbekistan. We know that you constantly communicate your concerns to the U.S. government. Do you feel like you're getting enough support? Do you feel you're in sync with the thinking and with the official position of the U.S. government on when it comes to this issue?
We do communicate a lot. I don't think we are in sync, but I do think we share some of the same goals. We have different roles to play. We as a civil society coalition, it is our role to identify significant abuses, and it is our role to advocate to the U.S. government to use its relationship to advance human rights goals. And it is also the U.S. government's own responsibilities. It has claimed its own responsibilities to, for example, ensure that U.S. businesses respect human rights in their operations abroad, and to do everything that the U.S. government can do to make sure that that happens. So I think the U.S. government can do more. It can be much more upfront with U.S. companies about the risks in Uzbekistan. It could work with those companies, U.S. companies operating in Uzbekistan, to then carry a message to the Uzbek government that, look, the investment environment here needs to change. It needs to be more stable, and there ought not be demands on multinational companies to contribute to the cotton harvest, for example.
Do you agree with those U.S. officials who think that the Uzbek economy needs to be diversified? That's one way to resolve this issue. It needs to be diversified. So we should really encourage more businesses to invest in Uzbekistan and diversify the economy so that the system is less dependent on cotton.
Right. I think it's not as related as it seems. I think the issue that we have honed in on and we think is the a number one issue is forced labor, use of coercion to motivate people to work. The Uzbek government today, tomorrow, could decide to stop using coercion as its means of recruiting people to work. In terms of the economic development of the country,
so it's just a question of political will.
It is. Diversity in the economy can have a tremendous amount of returns for other reasons. But, you know, many of our partners in Uzbekistan have reported forced labor in the silk sector, in the wheat sector, use of coercion to require public sector workers to do maintenance of city streets. So that is the issue that we're concerned about, because that's the human rights violation. I think there are plenty of experts out there that can speak to the pros and cons of diversifying the makeup of the Uzbek economy. But I think the gains to be had from removing coercion from the agricultural sector are tremendous. And that would be one of the most significant moments in the history of Uzbekistan for the government to stop its use of forced labor.
What is success for you?
Success is demonstrated commitment by the Uzbek government to stop forced labor. And when I say demonstrated, that means we need to see that it is halting officials from coercing people to work. So
the end of child labor, that was success.
It was partial success.
How about ILO now being on the ground in Uzbekistan, working there?
Sure. So I say partial success because, you know, right now during the harvest, we've seen forced child labor. because they've not changed the forced labor system, right? So long as from the prime minister down to the district level hokim or head of that district is getting orders that this harvest quota needs to be made or people are going to lose their jobs, etc. So long as that is the practice, use of threats to get people to meet the national production target for cotton, we're going to see forced child labor. And so that's why I say it was great, welcome, wonderful to see well over a million children no longer forcibly mobilized to the cotton fields nationwide in 2014, this year as well. But we still continue to see local officials force children out when they get anxious that they're not going to meet their cotton quota.
Now you have a higher number of adults forced labor.
Right, and exactly, so. And a higher number of adults. So is it also a success for the ILO to be there? It depends. I mean, the ILO, that it is its job to engage governments when the governments are not applying International Labor Organization conventions. The Uzbek government is not applying ILO conventions 29 and 105. The success comes when there are results of that intervention, right? I think the ILO faces a significant challenge in Uzbekistan. We continue to provide it as much information as we can so that its intervention can be a success.
Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.